references. So most of the material of these lectures is to be found in the book by Subir Sachdev, Quantum Phase Transitions. Mainly chapters one, five, 10, and maybe some bits from the second chapter. The duality discussed yesterday can be found in many places, but I advise you to read it from an old paper by Kogut. It's a review of modern physics from 1979. It's called something like Introduction to Spin Systems and Gauge Theories or something like that. And it's a read that I strongly advise you to do the whole paper. It's a very long paper, but if you go through it and you learn all there is there, it's a little treasure that you can take with you in your career of theoretical physics. So these are the main sources, and then I will give you a couple of papers to read for the material of the last two lectures. And I believe that all these chapters can be found on the PsI wiki or something like that. So they are online in the PSI page, in case you don't find the book in the library. I know you can't find it because it has already been plundered and you can't find it. Okay, so let's review briefly what we did yesterday. Okay, so we defined what quantum phase transitions are. And to do this, we have a notion of an infinite Hilbert space, and then we have a Hamiltonian that is smooth in a set of parameters. And the quantum critical point that marks a quantum phase transition, quantum critical point, GC, is a point in the parameter space such that the gap between, so the delta at the GC, that is the difference between the first excited state and the ground state energy, goes to zero in the thermodynamic limit. And a typical behavior we saw is this: for G close to GC, this behaves like some energy scale, G minus GC, to the Z nu. And correspondingly, there is a correlation length that scales, that diverges, like G minus GZ to the nu. And therefore, with some other coupling constant here, and therefore, by comparison, we see that at the critical point, delta and psi are related in this way. And this is what is called the dynamical critical exponent. And I believe that yesterday I placed the arrow on nu instead of z or something like that. Maybe I made a mistake. So anyway, z is the one called the dynamical critical exponent. OK. So this is what marks a quantum phase transition. And then we have our main model of study, that is the quantumizing model. That is the following Hamiltonian, defined on some lattice, that you can define on lattices of arbitrary dimensions. It's a spin-off system, of course. And we started looking at the 1D HI, and we saw that we have two phases, a small g phase that has these characteristics, that the ground state is unique, that correlation functions of, let me say, these, in these observables are either zero for the in the limit g going to infinity, or in the, sorry, this is the large g phase, of course. Or if you do perturbation theory in 1 over g, so you are putting this place back, this thing back, you have something that scales exponentially with the distance between these two spins and size the correlation length. And this means that there is no long range order. In particular, the expectation value of the magnetization for every I, and therefore also the average magnetization, is zero. So this is what is called, when you have these things, you call this stuff a quantum paramagnet. Just like you do for the classical ICI model, that you have a paramagnet at high temperature. And so when you have these strong thermal fluctuations, here now you have these strong, very strong quantum fluctuations given by the fact that the term, the transverse term, is very large. And again, you find that you do not have any magnetic order, and so you call it a quantum, this time paramagnet. And then we have a small g phase that is characterized by the fact that instead that these correlation functions, so this is the notation for this is Cij, are finite. So there is a long range order. There is a spontaneous magnetization that is tied to a breaking, you remember, of a Z2 symmetry that is just the flipping of all the spins around Z. And therefore, we have two. We have a degenerate ground state, all spins up, and all spins down that break the symmetry. So, degeneracy. So last thing we saw is that because we have two phases, we can argue that there is a quantum critical point in between. And under the assumption that this point is unique, duality, that is a mapping defined by the mapping from the original lattice to the dual lattice. And it's a mapping in variables I, so sigma and I to variables tau and mu. And we show that the Ising-Hamiltonian, quantum Ising-Hamiltonian in the variables sigma and I, so let me just say sigma, because sigmas carry I, at with the coupling constant G is identical to G times the same Hamiltonian, so the same functional form expressed in the form of the tau variables, and coupling 1 over G. So this is, in fact, because the model goes into itself under duality, this is called self-duality. And the consequence that we saw yesterday is that the critical point must be located at 1. And we know this just by duality. OK. Okay, so today we want to gather the tools that are necessary to talk about two very important notions that we need in the theory of quantum phase transitions. And so one is the quantum classical mapping. And two is the concept of universality. So how many of you are familiar with any of these two things? So what, which of the two are you familiar with? With universality? So what is universality? So universality is some insensitivity to the microscopic details of the theory. So in particular, we have universality at the critical point because many different theories have the same critical exponents, so the same qualitative behavior for the way the gap shrinks and the way correlation length diverges. Yep.
I'm very sorry. I have a small question regarding what you talked about before.
Yep.
I was just wondering, when you define the correlation length and also magnetization, what if you define magnetization to be in the x direction? So then in that case, the large G phase would
So this is a very important question. I believe that somebody asked this question also yesterday. I think it was you. So strictly speaking, correlation length is defined by what are the operators that we are looking at. On the other hand, one can prove on very general principles that if you have a gap, a finite gap, and the ground state is unique, so you don't have symmetry breaking, then all correlation functions will decay exponentially, and you will have the same correlation length that is defined by delta going like psi to the minus z, okay? So this is a very general theorem which allows us to unify all the different types of correlation length that we can imagine. However, this is an important question because very often we do not know whether there is a finite gap in the system or not. And this is actually very difficult to do. And typically what people do is to try to compute correlation functions and try to find, thanks to the relationship, the gap from there. And then it depends, you know, because in principle you should look at all the possible correlation functions in order to be sure that there is a gap. This can be a daunting task. The reason why, but so to go back to your question, why we don't look at the sigma x direction. The reason is that what is important in the system is the magnetic order that comes from symmetry breaking. Why that one is important? So you can see that mathematically it's important because something is happening, right? The ground state is not symmetric under the action of the symmetry of the Hamiltonian. So this is a mathematical difference. But physically, we have seen that this breaking of symmetry corresponds to the fact that the dynamics is broken in different ergodic sectors, meaning that if you start in a sector with initial conditions where the magnetization is positive, you stay there. And likewise, if you start from the negative one, which means that without external sources, the system will spontaneously acquire a magnetization. The magnetization in the x direction that is due to the fact that we have polarized the spins in the x direction is not spontaneous. If we send this source to zero, this G field to zero, then again we do not have a spontaneous polarization in the x direction. So that's why the relevant ones are those in the z direction, because this is the way the symmetry of this model is broken. And of course, because we already know this, because by this argument, we can see immediately that the ground state for small g is symmetry broken in this way, then I can easily say, OK, let's look at the correlation function in the z direction. So this is the answer to that. OK, so universality is some insensitivity. To the microscopic details of the theory, which means that there is a class of theories with different microscopic couplings which have the same critical exponents, for instance. And so how many of you are instead familiar with the quantum classical mapping? So I don't know if you did it in statistical mechanics. Did you? In the course at Psi, did you do this?
No.
Oh, OK. But I believe that you have done at least partially the transfer matrix method, right? OK. So we'll quickly review the transfer matrix method, because that you have used probably to solve the classicalizing model, right? This is the way you use the transfer matrix method. I will quickly reproduce those steps in order to show you that you can use the transfer matrix method, in fact, to introduce these two concepts. Okay, so let's start. So we start now with the classical theory. Let's start with the classical theory in 1D. Okay, then we will see what happens in higher dimensions. So the Hamiltonian is again in 1D. And my partition function is the sum over all the spin configurations of e to the minus h. So when I write it in this way, so I'm not writing explicitly the temperature, right? So this means that I am absorbing the classical temperature in this coupling constants. Okay? I could have put a classical temperature small t here. Okay? But so let me work in a temperature that is absorbed into this constant. So every time I will use capital T, it will be always the temperature for the quantum model. Okay. So this is similar to the quantumizing model, but the very big difference is that we have sigma z here. So this field is not transverse. Okay, so it means that the partition function is made by the by some weighted with Boltzmann weights probabilities of finding the system in some specific spin configuration and not in superposition of such. Okay? Okay, so we would like to compute the partition function. Okay, so let's do that. So I'm summing over all the possible configurations. And I have the exponential of the Hamiltonian. So I have h. So let me write this term first. And let's have a system that is that contains a number m, capital M, of spins. Okay, and also we put on this chain periodic boundary conditions. So it's a ring. Okay, so now let me define this function, these functions. So T1 of sigma z1, sigma z2, where 1 and 2 are just two indices. That is just e to the k sigma z1, sigma z2. And T2 of sigma z1, say, is just e to the h sigma z. So this is a function of four possible entries when sigma z1, sigma z2 are plus or minus 1, and this of two possible entries. So I can rewrite this exponential in this way. So I'm still summing over all the possible configurations. And then I have the product over all the spins of t1, sigma zl, sigma z, l plus 1. Times T2, sigma z, L. Do you agree? Okay. So you can see that this product, when I sum over all the possible configurations, has the form of a matrix product. Right? So imagine that I have, for the first pair of spins, I consider all these possible products. I can arrange them. You know, these are like the coefficients of two matrices. And what are these two matrices? This matrix here, so T1 in matrix form, is so when both spins have the same sign, is e to the k, e to the k, probably it's a 2. No, sorry. It's e to the k times the product. Yeah. Okay? And when they have different signs, you have this. And you are multiplying this one with this one. So T2 only contains the elements that correspond to one of the two spins. So it has this matrix form. So if you do the multiplication between these two matrices, you will see that just corresponds to the product of these two functions when I sum over all the possible spin configurations. And I'm doing this product for every pair of spins. And because I have periodic boundary conditions, then the L plus one spin is equal to the first one. So I am multiplying all the last T2 with the first T1. So this becomes T1, T2 times T1, T2 times T1, T2 as matrices, M times. And then I'm summing, I'm also doing the last product. So it's like taking the trace. Okay, so this is trace of this matrix T1, T2 to the M. So is this familiar? Is this the way you've done the? Okay. Well, then I can use the properties of the trace and write. So this trace will be equivalent to this. So now I have just to diagonalize this matrix. So I have to diagonalize the matrix T2 1/2. T1, T2, 1/2, which is, if you do the math, is e to the k plus h, e to the k minus h, e to the minus k, e to the minus k. Okay. So we diagonalize it. We find the two eigenvalues, epsilon 1 and epsilon 2. Which are something like e to the 2k cosh h plus minus. Now we have the same h square h plus e, I think, 2. Minus 2k into the 2k. All right. Okay. So we have these numbers. And therefore, our partition function, finally, so it's the trace of the powers of this, right? So it's just epsilon 1 to the m plus epsilon 2 to the m, which also means that we can immediately have the minus log. Just this, the free energy. OK, so far, so good. This is what you already know. So now, with the same method, we can compute correlation functions. And we will find that already computing correlation functions is very complicated in all its generality. And so when you did the transfer matrix method, did you do it with the H different from 0, or H was equal to 0? So if you, I don't know how you, so this is with H different from 0. But to compute the correlation functions, I would put H equal to 0. So it is possible to do with H different from 0, but it is an extremely long and tedious calculation that I will spare you. Because when we do the mapping to a quantum system, we will see that it is much easier to compute in the in the quantum setting, which is also why we like it very much. Okay, so what are the correlation functions? Well, they are the average of sigma z at L, sigma z L prime, the average made with this partition function. So this is the sum over all the spin configuration. One over z of e to the minus h sigma z L sigma z L prime. Okay, and now if we follow similar steps in writing now our T1 matrix and see how it be, but now, so we have this exponential that will contain this T1 matrix. T2 is not there anymore because I put h equal to 0. And then I have to see exactly how to do my things inside the trace, being careful that now these terms, so these terms will become polymatrices because in the matrix representation, these have two values that are plus 1 and minus 1. So I would like to write, they will become something like this, each of them. But then when I move things inside the trace, I have to be careful because now this matrix might not commute with the T1, all the T1 and all the T2. Sorry, the T2 are not there anymore, with all the T1s. We'll only compute with the T1s that are based on spins that are not involving L or L prime. So when you put things together, what you find is 1 over Z, the trace of, so you have T1 M minus L prime. Then you have the sigma Z that corresponds to L prime. Then you have the second sigma Z that corresponds to the other spin. And you have T1 to the L. Okay. So at the beginning, we have just T1 to the M. The trace of T1 to the M times sigma Z, but then I want to arrange them in this way because then I can diagonalize. And I diagonalize it by showing that the eigenvectors of T1 are easy to compute. So T1 is just that matrix that I wrote up there. And the eigenvectors are the right eigenvector. So remember, what is this? This is up plus down over square root of 2. And the left eigenvector where now, so these are the eigenvalues of this T1. Maybe I should call them lambda, but I'm calling them epsilon again just because such that does so, and I want to follow the same notation. And now epsilon 1 is 2 cos k, and epsilon 2 is 2 sin h k. And now you remember that, so if we, because T1 is diagonal in this basis, we use this basis to diagonalize it. So obviously, in this basis, T1 can be expressed just like epsilon 1, epsilon 2, because this is what we just said, right? In that basis, this is how you can express it. But sigma z, in this basis, so it's not diagonal anymore. It's not this one anymore. So, and in fact, sigma z in the eigenvectors of sigma x, you should know that is as the matrix representation, this one, that is sigma x in the sigma z basis. All right. Okay, so you have all this product of matrices that you do, and in the end, So you do a little bit of algebra or matrix multiplications, and you find that the correlation functions are just epsilon 1 minus L, epsilon 2 to del prime minus L, plus epsilon 2 M minus L prime plus L, epsilon 1. This is the expression for the correlation functions for the finite ring with m spins. Now we want to take the thermodynamic limit. So m goes to infinity. And you do the math, and you find when you place what epsilon 1 and epsilon 2 are, this is just the hyperbolic tangent of k to L prime minus L. I remember that we computed this for h equals 0. And believe me, for h different from 0, the calculation is very, very tedious. So we'll do it in a different way. OK. So now with these results, we can talk about what we need to do to introduce both the quantum classical mapping and universality, and later to talk about quantum field theories, and it is the scaling limit. So the scaling limit is based on this idea. Yep.
I'm sorry, but
you want to know how to get this?
Yeah.
OK, so I am using both the cyclic property of the trace and the fact that these sigma z's will commute or not. So I can only commute with some parts of the T1, of this power of T1, depending whether this T1 is acting on that spin based at L or L prime or not. Okay, so this is the way you find that expression.
So in this case, sigma z commutes with the T1 L prime minus L.
Yeah, so this one could carry this L prime, this one could carry this L. But just to remind you that originally it was this spin here and this spin here. So what you do, so you have T1 to the something like this. And in this trace, so you can put the L prime here because it's cyclic. And now you can put on the left of L prime these ones because they will commute because I have not reached L prime yet. And on the right of L, all those that are before L prime. So here I'm working with the assumption that L prime is greater than L, without loss of generality. OK. So what is the scaling limit? So now we want to start using the things that we know about quantum phase transitions. So namely, what we know is that near the quantum critical point, psi is very large. Right? Because we know it's diverging. But in order to make some quantitative comparison, so we know it's diverging, so in some sense it will be large. But before it diverges, when is very large. So it's very large with respect to what? So we need a second length scale. So the second length scale, so right now in the theory there are no more length scales. There is nothing else. So what we do is, that is to embed our graph in real space. Okay? So what we have our chain. And we have L, L plus 1, right? But now we embed it in R. So now we can say that this distance is some physical distance. It's a real number that is A. And A is the lattice constant. What is called the lattice constant. OK, so now we can say that the scaling limit is when psi with respect to A goes to infinity. So physically, what does it mean? Is that what it means is that spins are correlated over regions of space that are much larger than the distance between two nearest neighbors. And we would like to understand what are the implications of this. We can see where universality can come from. If the correlations are stronger over distances that are larger than the microscopic distance, then maybe the microscopic details wouldn't matter. So we don't know for sure, but this is a necessary condition. If you were not in the situation, then you are failing from the beginning. Okay. So now, so let me see. What are the other length scales? Now that we have introduced A, we have the total length of the chain, that is just M times A. Total length. And this is it. Okay. So what I was calling sigma z of L, so the value of this variable at L, now it will be. So this coordinate L becomes a tau that is defined by being L times A. And so it's a special coordinate, and they call it tau, though, because later it will behave a little bit like time, imaginary time when we do the mapping to a quantum mode. So this will be Sz of tau. Okay, so with these definitions, our correlation functions become so now I will posit L equal to 0, the first site. Okay. And if I define, so if I take this expression, so this is just tau, right? And I define psi to the minus 1 to be 1 over A, this is tau over A, right? 1 over A log hyperbolic cotangent of k, this becomes e to the minus tau over psi. Okay, so we can see this exponential form for our correlation functions. So in this 1D model, classical, we do not have a critical point. Therefore, these correlation functions always have some finite psi, but we can still do the scaling limit. Okay, we can still see what happens when we are looking at the system on scales if we put ourselves in a situation where xi is much larger than a. Okay, so in order to do that, we use this expression. And we want to understand when this thing is large. Okay, but we use this expression. Okay, so this thing is large when k is very large. And if you do the usual approximations, this thing approximates like e to the 2k, which is much larger than 1. So this is for k very large. Okay? So this is, for our system, the relevant scaling limit approximation. And now we would like to see what our theory looks like in this approximation. Because now you see, I can substitute for the coupling constants, I can put some length scales instead of k. Well, then I have h, and I don't know what h looks like because I didn't do the calculation. And so in principle, I should compute the correlation, the complete correlation functions, and I should see how both k and h behave with respect to my length scales. So I don't want to do that because it's complicated. So I will cheat. And I will give you a physical argument that could be very wrong, but it turns out to be right. And the physical argument is, OK, so we are thinking that we are in the region where k is very large. Okay, so if k is very large, and psi, therefore, is very large, so it means the spins are correlated at long distance. So if they are correlated at long distance, and means that nearby spins must point in the same direction. If they are correlated at large distance, when they are close, they are very strongly correlated, and therefore they must point in the same direction. If they are pointing the same direction, the field that they are feeling is not necessarily the field on each of them, but I can substitute, it means that the field is not varying, right, over lengths of order A. So I can substitute the average. So I will substitute to h, I will substitute h tilde, that is h over a, just the average over this short length distance. Okay. So this is a very hand-waving argument, but it works, because when you solve the system exactly, you see that it works. So we are allowed to do that. Okay, so a comment that such def does, and that I find it very interesting, is the following. And is that, so when I take this scaling limit, I can think of doing this limit in two possible ways. So I could send a to 0. So I can imagine that I am considering that my chain, my lattice, becomes a continuum. But by keeping all the lengths, so the lengths that we have are L, are psi, are h tilde to the minus 1. I can keep them constant and send a to z. Okay, so this is a way of doing the scaling limit. Or I can do an equivalent thing, that is to send, keep a fixed and send m to infinity. So more or less, these two approaches are the approaches of the first one of a particle physicist, the second one of the condensed matter physicist. Because in condensed matter, you do actually have lattice spacings. But they are completely equivalent. But for the calculations, We will use the particle physics approach. And now let's see how our theory transforms under the scaling limit. Okay. So first of all, I want to compute two things. I want to compute my free energy density. In the scaling limit. So the free energy density is just the free energy over the total size of the system. So this is just okay. So we need to see how epsilon 1 and epsilon 2 transform. Right? So we have our original epsilon 1 and epsilon 2 that are here. And we want to see what happens when k can be expressed in terms of psi over A, and H can be expressed in terms of H tilde over A. So if you do this substitution, I will not bore you with the details of the calculation because this is just algebra, you find this. So you just substitute these behaviors in the boxes in the expression for epsilon 1, epsilon 2 that are here. And you have this. And we can do it exactly for epsilon 1, epsilon 2, because when we solved for epsilon 1, epsilon 2, we did it for in the full generality, also when H was different from 0. Okay, now here we want to take we want to put this inside here. Okay, because that is just epsilon 1 to the m plus epsilon 2 to the m. And take the limit for m going to infinity. And what we find is the following thing. So let me put this inside. So this is the formula for the free energy density that is good in the limit when k is large, l is large with respect to a. And this is the formula. So let's look at it. So we have this term that we can call E0. And it is basically the average, so the average energy per lattice site. So it's some offset, okay? Then we have this term here, and I want to call it phi sigma. And as you can see, this is a function of just lambda. L over psi. and H tilde. And I'm missing something here. And I believe that there is a missing term. There is an L here too. Okay. So it is a function of the dimensionless numbers that I can take by combining the three length scales that I have, that are L, H, and H tilde to the minus one. So now we are in the position of saying, what is universality? So now imagine that I change the microscopic details of my theory. So I add a term k prime sigma z l a sigma z l plus 2. So this is next near neighbors. But still of the same type. So I'm quite changing the Hamiltonian. But somehow the spins are still interacting with an Ising coupling when they're close. So if universality makes any sense when I go at larger distances with respect to a few lattice spacings, this shouldn't count so much. Well, so if you redo the whole calculation. So you can redo the transfer matrix method exactly the same. Maybe it's a little bit longer. You will find two things. You will find that in zero now becomes minus k plus k prime over a. So it's again the average then energy per site. But it's not the same, right? So this is a non-universal correction. But then you will find that this function is exactly the same. So I leave this to you as an exercise, if you feel like doing it. But you will find exactly the same function. So this is the meaning of universality. When I compute the free energy density, I add a term that quite changes my Hamiltonian, changes my ground state, many things, but the behavior of the free energy density at large length scales is the same. So this is universal. And regarding, and I'm sorry, I put here sigma, I should have put F, because it's the universal function for the free energy density. Phi sigma is the universal function for the correlation functions. So we will find that C tau is some universal function of tau over L, L over Xi, and H tilde L. But now I have all these length scales in play. And now, but this one, I cannot even try to tell you what it is. So here you see which is the function. It's 2 cos square root of these ratios, right? But here I cannot do it because I actually was not able to compute this in presence of an external field. So we will see how it is tomorrow when we map this model to a quantum model. And then we'll see how much easier it is to compute the full correlation functions and see what is the universality, universal function for the correlation functions. Yep.
Stuff we did, what you wrote down in the box with the cheat, it goes to H. Is that totally clear to me what exactly you mean? So it seems like you're saying that we take H to zero, something, because if we keep H tilde the same and A goes to zero, then of course H.
So
what kind of limit are we taking, or what does it mean, the substitution?
So we are taking A to zero in a way such that H tilde is fixed.
So we're taking the external field to zero.
So we are taking a very small external field. But in a way such that the ratio, the average, is a finite number, H tilde. Other questions?